Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour. Today is an episode that I actually feel emotional about. I've met a new friend as we conducted this interview. J Mark is their first name. Accento is their last name. So JEMARC, AXINTO, and all of their social media is that name. So you can go look them up. And I guess the reason I'm feeling emotional is because I'm realizing that the work that I've done for the last 25 years through the lens of psychology and yoga, philosophy, and spirituality is so similar to what J Mark has discovered for themselves through life experience, through their studies of Buddhism, through being a scientific mind. Through the traumas of life, I felt like I was talking to myself. I felt like it was like this mirror of, someone that gets what we're doing. And especially with regards to healing the nervous system and retraining neural pathways and how to heal from trauma and how it's different than what people might have in a more clinical psychology or psychiatric setting, which we also both agree is necessary. And I feel like this interview, especially for people who have had a multitude of different symptoms that may seem unrelated, but they are all connected through the nervous system. And as you all know, that's like my special interest is the nervous system. And I was just so, number one, pleasantly surprised at J Mark's authenticity and ability to explain what's going on and tell stories and be very present, connected human being. I mean, that's the basis of it. But to know how they came to this understanding, which was different than how I've come to this understanding, I was just like, wow, the world is such an amazing place and humans are so incredible. So I hope you enjoy this interview. I'm thinking that a lot of you listening, after about the first 10 minutes, you're going to be like, wait a minute, this is my story. This is exactly how I feel. This person is able to speak of it in a way that I've not yet been able to explain it to myself, much less anyone else. I have to listen to this interview multiple times because the words that are coming out of J Mark are the sensations in my body that have yet found a way out so that anyone else can understand who I am and my humanity. I think, a lot of yoga people, whether we know it or not, a lot of us are neurodivergent. We are introverts. We have had complex trauma, difficult childhoods. I think that's why we found yoga, yoga philosophy, yoga therapy. And now, as J Mark speaks, let's add Buddhism to the mix. I think that's why we're here. That's why we're attracted to these places where science meets spirituality. And I love what J Mark said about maybe it's good to go to a therapist first and do the unpacking with a licensed clinical therapist and then arrive in phase two where we're looking forward. Like, how do I want to live? Who do I want to be? What is the healed version of myself? How can I be authentic and actually show up in the world the way I want to show up and have the experiences I want to have? So I think many of you are really going to enjoy this episode. I'm so excited to introduce you to my new friend, J Mark Accento, and let's get into it.
Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour podcast. Did you know that we give a free gift with each and every guest? Every month, we go back and find a gift either from the guests themselves, or we find a research article or something really interesting that goes along with the topic, and we send it out once a month. There's many different categories you can sign up for, and look in the show notes, and it will show you how you can get to that link to sign up for our free gift every single guest. All right, let's get into the show and go meet our guest for today.
Welcome, J Mark. So happy to have you here today.
Hello, I'm so happy to be here. Hello, hello.
I can't wait to talk to you about so many things. We've agreed upon a few questions, but I have a feeling we will wander off into the weeds a little bit, just getting to know you a little bit before we got on here and started recording. But let's start with just kind of a basic question. What inspired you to become a trauma recovery coach and wellness consultant? But specifically, where science and spirituality meet.
Yeah, so, growing up Asian American military brat, naturally mental health wasn't at the forefront of my mind for very much of my life. And then upon meeting my spouse, my best friend Ezra, and forming a relationship with them, within the first year of our relationship, and we've been together for 9 years now, they became chronically ill. They started having seizures. And when we got them checked for the seizures, it turned out that it was actually from unresolved PTSD and CPTSD. The good news
Wow.
is, after the diagnosis, the seizure stopped. It was like the brain was like, finally, you heard me. And then they developed fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, and POTS syndrome. So, for 3 to 4 years of our relationship, basically the first half of our relationship, there'd be weeks, sometimes months at a time, where they couldn't physically get out of bed. And they were in pain constantly. And with POTS, they couldn't stand for long periods of time, let alone with chronic fatigue. We literally had a wheelchair, an electric scooter, one of those rollergator things, a bedside commode. It was terrifying. And then in 2018, and a bit of trigger warning to your audience that has to do with suicide, but they had an attempt. And fortunately, without getting into the details of it, fortunately they survived. And, every physician we went to during that time period, first of all, in Western medicine, none of the physicians were talking to each other. So that was its own challenge, especially for all the complex patients out there listening. Secondly, they kept passing the buck, essentially. Maybe this person has the answer. Maybe this person has the answer. It's like when you're a kid and you're like, hey, mom, can I go out to play? And they're like, ask dad. Hey, dad, can I go to play? Ask mom. And you're just bouncing back and forth, but it's a life or death situation. And then in 2018, we were living in Baltimore at the time, getting ready to move, maybe around like 2016, 2017. But we found a book at a take a book, leave a book place in Baltimore in a warehouse. And it was written by this physician that was from Baltimore who actually had all of Ezra's conditions, fibro, chronic fatigue, and made a full recovery. His name was Dr. Teitelbaum. And he had to drop out of med school for 3 years and be homeless because of his conditions. The world was just too much. And he made a full recovery. And we were so desperate at that point that we were like, none of these physicians are helping us. Let's just take a leap of faith. He did concierge medicine. It was like $5,000 we had to drop to work with him. And fortunately, it did work out. He introduced us to this concept that, like, hey, all this is rooted in trauma. You can heal trauma. And he was an internal medicine doctor. So he was doing a lot with like hormones and supplements and all this stuff. But he was like, if you really want to heal this, you need to target the nervous system. And we're like, okay, electroshock therapy, drugs. Like, no, you can actually retrain your nervous system and no longer be traumatized. And after Ezra's attempt, they went all in on doing that. Because the thing about it, and to talk again about this difficult subject, I'm going to use a word that I like using because it doesn't quite trigger the limbic system. I like to call it like hazy thoughts is like ideation, voidy thoughts is like active. The thing that people don't realize about haziness and voidness is that it is, you're not consciously consenting to that. People are like, it's so selfish. It's like, no, your brain is on autopilot. It is the ultimate form of flight. And when Ezra woke up in the hospital in 2018, they didn't remember the attempt. In fact, they didn't remember the attempt until it's 2024 now, until 2 months ago. They finally remembered all the details of it. The memory came back. But for a long time, they had zero memory of what was one of the worst days of my life. And to know that their brain could autopilot into something so permanent, healing had to become their number one priority over everything else. And so, as of 2020, they were in med school finally, and they were on their feet 12 hours a day. They were doing rotations. We sold the bedside commode. We sold the scooter. We sold the wheelchair. We sold everything. They made a full recovery. Now, you talk to their physicians. Of course, you can't because, we have HIPAA. But if you were to talk to their physicians, they would still have, like, has CPTSD, has these conditions on their file, but they don't. They're not taking any medication or treatment for any of it. They have completely rewired complex PTSD, PTSD, depression, anxiety, fibro, everything out of their nervous systems and bodies. And witnessing them doing something so profound that every physician told us this is the rest of our life now was like, oh, there's a gap. There's something missing. And so the way I got into this work was after Ezra's initial big burst of recovery, we went on a retreat with a teacher. And Ezra had been working with this teacher for some time. And because I wasn't in this world, I was like, you met this person online, you're paying them how much every session, and now you want to fly to Ibiza? Excuse me? No, I'm going to go with you. This is sketchy as hell. Went with Ezra, ended up surprisingly loving the experience myself. And I remember telling the teacher this story, and they looked at me and they're like, you're ready to teach now. And I was like, excuse me? No, I want to be an actor. Like, I want Kevin Feige to call me and ask me to be in a Marvel movie, or I want to work with Christopher Nolan in one of his epics, or I want to work with Edgar Wright. Like, I don't want to do this. There's no part of my life that ever, like, maybe when I was a kid, I thought about going into becoming a psychiatrist or therapist, but like, no, I want to act. I want to perform. That's my way of expressing. But, here we are, thousands of miles from home, and they told me this in confidence. And then suddenly, something karmically happened, and people came up to me privately and were like, hey, can we talk one-on-one? So I had my first quote-unquote sessions with people on a retreat for an entirely different teacher because they came up to me privately. I was like, sure, I'll hold space for you. And then it just kind of snowballed from there. And so that was in 2020. And then by 2021, I had quit my corporate job and started doing it full time. And really helping people. And it took me a long time to claim trauma recovery coach. One, because of the imposter syndrome of it. Like, I'm not licensed. I'm not trained in the same way that Westerners consider valid in this work. And so, I'm married to a med student who's trained to be a psychiatrist. Like, there was a lot of insecurity there. And my spouse has had to reassure me many times because there's been numerous conversations, especially during their first 2 years of med school, where I was like, hey, maybe I'll sign up for the PhD psych program. And they looked at me and they're like, babe, you know more than my teachers do. Please stop. We don't need more debt. I'm like, okay, as long as you're sure. And they've been through med school. I do know more than their teachers do when it comes to trauma healing specifically. And so that's been incredibly validating. And that's how I got into it, was that. And then the answer to the second question of that intersection, right? It's just a lot of it has to do with just letting go of any preconceived notion of an absolute idea and understanding that everything feeds into each other, right? Like, of course, people listening, I'm sure there's some religious trauma, but you look at any of the great historical scientists, there was always an integration of God, of spirit in their work. The idea that science and spirituality can't coexist is actually within the timeline of human history, a more recent concept. When in actuality, it can all be integrative. What if the Big Bang and God's single word that spoke, that birthed the universe, was the exact same thing, and just different perspectives for reaching that thing. And so my intersection is about being delightfully skeptical of both sides. I'm a huge geek, so if this doesn't resonate with your audience, I apologize. But there's this great anime called Fullmetal Alchemist Brotherhood. And the entire premise of the anime is about just being delightfully human and relishing in your humanity. And the main characters are alchemists in this world, are scientists, and they're very like, religion's nonsense. And then there's another person who's like super religious and is like, see, that's proof. But then another person's a scientist and they're like, see, science above all. And that person did great harm. It's about how do you find that intersectionality between it to find an answer? How do I work with someone who's more science oriented and get them to open their mind to this idea of an absolute truth, this idea of spirit? How do I go to someone and work with somebody who's more spiritually oriented and ground them back in reality? In my lineage of Buddhism, it's just the middle way. And so that's how I've approached it. And thank you, everyone, for listening to my answer TED Talk. I have ADHD, y'all, so she can just monologue always.
This is going to be such an easy interview. I'll just like say a question, which I love. I mean, I want our audience to hear from you and understand you, right? So this is great. As you were speaking about being a trauma recovery coach and kind of your maybe insecurity around that, on one hand, I understand that because Probably there are times we do need to make referrals to psychologists or psychiatrists. There truly is a time and place for people to have more than one support system, right? And I believe in allopathic medicine as well as our Western way of looking at, psychology. There is this link missing, which is the nervous system. And everything you said, from POTS to fibromyalgia to, all the things, even seizures, the common thread is the nervous system. And we don't actually have a healthcare professional. I think yoga therapists are starting to approach that too, but we don't really have someone who's focusing on what are tools that you can do for yourself and lifestyle changes and perceptual changes and acceptance of who you are and how you show up in the world around the nervous system. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. And we're really just talking about broad strokes here. Of course, there are physicians, but they're few and far in between, and they're considered fringe, and they're considered on the outskirts, and they're considered cowboys in the field. And that's the thing too, is that so much of medicine, the way it's taught in the Western world, and I now have this knowledge as a partner in med school, is all about like symptoms and diagnoses. And there's no question of like, what's your trauma history? What was your childhood like? So much of our dis-ease comes from unresolved childhood trauma. And it's just a question of how your personal brain manifests. I'm going to say this, and people are going to get more medically inclined, people get up in arms, and I recognize that. But this is strictly like a perspective I have, and I'm fully open to it being challenged and changed. But to me, something like dissociative identity disorder and schizophrenia are not all that different. Of course, the way they present themselves are very different, the way they're experienced are very different. But if instead we can perceive them as like, at some point as a child, there was difficulty in trusting your inner voice and your ability to trust yourself. And so there became a physical outward manifestation in the way you experience the world. In terms of schizophrenia, it's in the term of what would be called hallucinations. In terms of DID, it'd be in the form of other alters. But like we know internal family systems are a thing. And your alters, generally speaking, if a person has DID, is trying to protect them. So if it's a question of like, oh, a lot of it starts in childhood, for many people starts in utero, how do we approach that? Like every disease out there is rooted in a spike of stress, right? Even as simple as like pulling a muscle. We don't have to talk mental health right now. Like if I go to the gym right now and I try to strain and strain to bench 200 pounds, having not done that since I was in high school, I will hurt myself. But yet somehow we think going, burning out over and over and over and over again, you get sick and you go, I have no idea how this happened. The doctors have no idea. It's like we know how it happens, but it's not talked about. It's like we're living in an unsustainable system where these expectations are to constantly push yourself to achieve some impossible outcome when really the goal is to be joyously present with your life as it is now. But once again, that's a platitude right now. I can tell people, like, you want to learn how to be joyously present with how it is now. And also, I recognize that the system we live in doesn't support that. Yeah.
That's really it. I mean, we're going to get into neurodiversity and neurodivergence, but most of the people I work with also, of course, they'd love a joyous present existence, but somebody's got to pay the bills,
Yes.
and the requirement of society to work that 9 to 5 job, you cannot rewire your nervous system. You can't take those radical steps unless you have a supportive spouse or someone or parents that are willing to support you financially.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Ezra and I would not be where we were today if it wasn't for the financial support of both our family systems to the extent that they can financially support, And like we still have financial anxiety even with that. I was one of these people. I had the 9 to 5 corporate job. I had the like, this is what you worked for. This is what everybody wants. And we still needed financial support. And that was part of why I left for my current career was like, I'm making all this money. I still can't afford to pay bills and I'm miserable. So maybe I need to sacrifice the misery and try to find a way to be happy. Yes, there's still financial anxiety, but at least I'm not killing myself and I can support my spouse in different ways. So, yeah.
Hello, are you interested in polyvagal theory? Well, if so, I have two really cool things you might be interested in. One is an app called the Mighty Network, where Marlisa Sullivan and myself are hosting a yoga therapy and polyvagal theory group, and it's free. You can just join the group, come in and share thoughts and ideas on polyvagal theory, yoga, and yoga therapy. We try to post every week, stimulating a community around yoga, the nervous system, and polyvagal theory. So we'd love to have you join us. In addition, we are giving a 7-week class on polyvagal theory and yoga starting in the fall. You can find that on www.polyvagalinstitute.org, O-R-G. So we'd love to invite you to that 7-week course that's starting in September of 2024.
So let's say that someone does find a way to get out of that rat race to heal themselves. What does it mean when you say the process of radically rewiring the brain to heal trauma?
Yeah. So our brains have these grooves in them. They're neural pathways. And neural pathways, they're formed of a bunch of neurons communicating to each other. And the neurons like talking about the same stuff. So if you are somebody who your special interest is like Dungeons and Dragons, then you're going to have a lot of neurons in your brain that love talking about Dungeons and Dragons. Mm-hmm. Now, within the context of trauma, let's say you grew up a parentified child. So one of your parents are incredibly inappropriate with you. They're constantly telling you all their business, telling you all their troubles. And you internalize this belief that in order to feel safe at home, you have to be overly responsible for everybody and kind of controlling. Those neural pathways are strong, and you become an adult who has those behavioral patterns, but they're rooted in trauma. And so to radically rewire your brain, what you're doing is telling your brain steadily over time that you can let control go. Mm. And to do that, and part of the process that I teach the people I work with, is by teaching your brain to normalize and feel comfortable with peace and safety and hope and joy. A lot of people think trauma healing is getting used to chaos. Like, no, your brain is normalized chaos. When you have lived with compounded trauma over time, the limbic system, which is the mammalian brain, it's responsible for emotional memory. It has the hippocampus, has the amygdala. The limbic system, its job is supposed to be acute danger, turn on, activate, fight, flight, freeze, fawn, flop. And then acute danger gone, turn off. But when you've dealt with compounded trauma, the limbic system eventually reaches a point of like, oh, I need to be on all the time. It's why I tell people like, look, have you ever had a really, really good day? And then the minute you sit down and pause to try to enjoy it, you feel a pit drop in your stomach and you're like, oh, something bad's about to happen. That is what I mean when I say you need to rewire your brain. Your nervous system is not used to peace. What's happening in that moment when the pit drops is your brain is going, okay, well, all this dopamine and serotonin and oxytocin and endorphins, they've been nice, but we're used to producing cortisol and adrenaline. So here's a cortisol spike when nothing's happening. So your brain is literally just producing cortisol because it's what it is, what it has normalized for itself. So the rewire the brain is to teach the brain, hey, you don't need to unnecessarily send these cortisol spikes anymore. You can even use it within the language of addiction. I use normalize because it's very gentle, but really your brain is addicted to cortisol and adrenaline. And so part of why it's a radical process is every client I've worked with, I've yet to work with someone who this didn't happen, as long as they really did the work, at some point felt like they were getting worse.
Yeah.
Suddenly their symptoms felt worse. Suddenly they felt more sensitive. Suddenly new symptoms would arise and they'd be like, this isn't working. I'm getting worse. Here are all the reasons. And I would have to remind them, because I say this in every intake call, is like, at some point you're going to feel worse. You're going to forget we had this conversation when it's happening. But that's a sign that it's working. In the same way that if you go through withdrawal when you're getting off an actual physical substance like alcohol or meth or heroin or anything like that, when you start teaching your brain to no longer normalize these stress chemicals, there will be a withdrawal period and sometimes multiple withdrawal periods. But that means it's working. And if you are willing to trust that it's working and keep doing the work, even though your brain is screaming at you to stop, that's how you get to the other side. And that's why it's radical, because it's scary to have someone be like, I need help. I'm in pain. And for me, my personal promise to be as honest as I can be like, okay, just so you know, at some point you will be in more pain. It's radical to be like, I'm willing to try that if it means it'll work. It's radical to say, I want to completely change how I feel moment to moment, because we like patterns. There's a great quote by Thich Nhat Hanh a Vietnamese Buddhist teacher credited with bringing simple monk practices to the West. I'm paraphrasing heavily, but it was people are so afraid of change that when it comes to suffering, they would rather pick the suffering that's familiar or something like that. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's just so interesting. I've worked with people in this situation too, and it takes sometimes 2 or 3 years. I don't meet with people every week or anything, but it takes a while to rewire that. And so many other pieces of their lives end up getting reorganized as a result. I think that's why it takes so long, because maybe they have a session with you or me, and then they have a new perception and they make a decision. And then a couple of other chess pieces need to be moved around to support that decision. That needs to stabilize. Then there's a little more movement over here. Is that what you find, that it takes a while?
Oh, it takes a long time. Actually, the only work that I do officially as a program, it's a 3-month condensed like rewire your brain boot camp. And every client I've worked with, they're like, it's like drinking out of a water hose. And I'm like, hey, at least you have access to it in perpetuity until I change that policy. So you can keep coming back to it. It can take years. And because part of it taking years too is because it's a big deal to say my well-being is my number one priority. It's very easy to say it. It's really hard to mean and commit to it.
And
And
do it.
so, and do it. Yeah. And so, part of why, too, I have this 3-month program, and the door is always open for people who want to keep working with me, is I'm so determined for people not become hyper dependent upon me. My work is like, hey, I'm going to teach you this process. I'm going to offer the science. I'm going to offer the somatic part. I'm going to offer the spiritual lens. But this will only really work if you are self-empowered, if you are radically responsible for your own healing. As a Buddhist, I tell them, like, I could die tomorrow. And if I die tomorrow, like, don't get me wrong, pour one out for the dead friend. But I need you to be like, I'm okay. I need you to want yourself to say that you'll be okay if I disappear. Because if you're not, then I failed you. Because you need to feel so radically self-empowered in this process that you know that you'll make it through. And it also just helps me to be like, I'm not taking advantage of people in pain.
So I think I understand your work, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but it's almost like phase one is allowing people to grieve and to understand how they ended up here, and maybe even find some acceptance around, oh my gosh, I have neurodiversity, or I have neurodivergence, or CPTSD. Like, there's a time where you get to actually identify with what has happened so that you can accept it and understand yourself. But then I see your work in phase two. There's also this idea of co-creating a world that's no longer ruled by trauma reactivity and stepping into your authentic self. What do you think? How would you describe it?
Yeah, so that phase one bit oftentimes is something that I tell people, go to therapy if you're comfortable with it. Therapy, from my experience, my perspective, at least for a lot of the therapists trained in the West, is all about unpacking, which is important. Unpacking can create context, it can help reduce shame, it can help provide a guiding point. But the work that I do with clients, unless something acute happens in the present moment, we don't go into the past. Because if we do, what we're doing is reinforcing those neural pathways in the brain that say you are traumatized, reinforcing the production of those stress chemicals. So, of course, stuff comes up acutely and we talk about it. And sometimes we dig into the past, but it's not the main point of the work. It's about the present and the future. It's about letting go. Now, in terms of co-creating a world no longer ruled by trauma reactivity, and I know you know this as well, Amy, when you really do the work, you realize, oh, there aren't bad people. Everyone's just traumatized.
That's
Like,
not true.
even for whatever everyone's politics are listening to this, like, even people who stormed January 6th, right? Stormed the Capitol on January 6th, even Trump, even what's happening overseas right now. Like, if you just remove as much of the complexity as you can and simplify, and I recognize these aren't simple issues, I'm not saying they are, but if you just take it from like, at what point did someone decide they need to fight so desperately to prove that they exist and to the detriment of others? And then you begin examining your own life and you're like, oh, wow, I've done that a lot. You know that phrase, absolute power corrupts absolutely? I fundamentally disagree with it. I think absolute power corrupts when it is in the hands of somebody with unhealed trauma. I think that is a more accurate statement of the fact, because power itself is neutral, right? That's why there are people with power who've done great things, people with power who've done terrible things. It's a question of what unresolved work are they doing? If we instead perceive everybody as just children, like literally everyone across the board as children at different ages, sure, then like, are we giving the nuclear codes to a child that never received support and never received the secure attachment that they needed? Or are we giving the nuclear codes to someone who was able to self-actualize as a human? And then the person who self-actualized probably be like, we don't need nukes. Why do we have this? Let's get rid of them, right? Clearly, that hasn't happened because everyone, again, that fear narrative, but what if they use their nukes? Same thing with guns. What if they use their guns? Well, you think, what if they use their guns? Because some part of you thinks one day you'll need to use your gun. So, of course, we can't let go of that idea and that concept of it. And it's all trauma. Why do we feel like we have to equip ourselves with weapons? Because our nervous systems feel like they have to defend themselves against some unseen threat. So, to co-create a world that's no longer ruled by trauma reactivity, it comes down to every single person that I work with, either as a coach or a consultant. It is when you, individual, show up and you are no longer reactive, then you can model and inspire others to do the same for themselves. It's like the movie Pay It Forward, but with healing. That's all it is.
I completely agree with you, and I tell myself that exact thing that you're describing almost every time I'm hurt by someone or if I hurt them, to give compassion and empathy. And there's also this part of me that's like, and we need to put some guardrails because we can't just allow them to go hurt people or even allow ourselves to go hurt people.
Yeah, I often say, and I know I said some really radical stuff earlier, but like, this doesn't excuse behavior,
Right.
right? We're just creating context of understanding about like, oh, these people are traumatized. It doesn't mean, oh no, poor traumatized people, we should feel bad about them hurting people. No, not at all. We just create context and understanding. I always say, because I have people come to me and they're like, hey, I really love this person and care for this person. They're actively hurting me. How do I set boundaries? Because I'm worried if I set boundaries, something will happen with the relationship, right? And I tell them, like, you have to love them so much that you no longer consent to the worst parts of themselves. That's all it is. You're saying, I know you're better than this. I'm not going to consent to you continuing this behavior, not just for myself and my protection, but because you deserve better than continuing that behavior. And then the entire ethos of everything I said earlier was just, I said this in a reel like months ago. It is, I refuse to dehumanize you as you attempt to dehumanize me. Because to do so would further dehumanize myself. It doesn't mean you don't set boundaries. Also, it doesn't mean you're messy sometimes, right? Like, my next door neighbor is a nightmare, incredibly odious person, incredibly unhappy person. I have had dark thoughts about things I wish would happen to my neighbor. I don't act on them though. And then, even like, I even try to still be kind, but I'm human and I'm not awakened. I'm not a guru. Like, I'm still very much attached to so many things. But because I've done a lot of trauma healing work, I'm not screaming at them every time I see them on the street. I'm not attacking them or doing terrible things. I'm just like, oh, okay.
Breathe, breathe, J Mark.
Yeah, that's all it is.
When you were talking, what image came to mind is that we are holding the vision of them working towards their higher self, their most authentic self, their true self, before they even know that that's the journey. Like
Yes.
we can see that and not accept the behavior. And of course, we need to keep ourselves and people safe. And, I had this thing happen in the thrift store the other day where a woman was being very homophobic, and someone from being in line stepped up and said, "That's unacceptable." And I was like, "Whoa, way to go, lady." Like, I was so impressed with her. And as the woman who had been, having the homophobic rant was going out of the store, the woman who had confronted her said, "You know what? I hold the space that you will one day see that your daughter and her partner are worthy of love." And I just about cried. I actually got the woman's text. I was like, "Can we be friends? I just moved here." But I think that's what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like, generally speaking, you talk to a lot of people who are like, J Mark's always been great. And of course, we're always like hyper consciously aware of our faults and flaws. And I'm like, I've hurt so many people in my life and thought myself unforgivable and thought myself undeserving of love and affection and care because of my perceptions of the harm I've caused in my life. But if I stayed in that state of mind, I would have continued causing harm.
Right.
And so for me to heal, it wasn't just like, oh, I heal, it's great. It's like, no, this is possible for everyone. Some of the most heinous, heinous people in the world have healed. There's this really great guy. His name is Daryl Davis. He is this incredible, I want to say, jazz musician, black man, who for the past, I think it's been 40 years now, almost 40 years, has collected Klan robes by just sitting down and having conversations with active members of the Ku Klux Klan. And by meeting them human to human, convincing them, like, oh, you're not scary. I don't have to hate you. Oh, I got into this because I felt disenfranchised as a young age, and this was the only place that gave me community. When you're able to do something, I don't know if I'm strong enough to do that, but like when you're able to do something that radical and that incredible and that profound, to me, that's what co-creating a world no longer ruled by trauma is. And you know, to be extra edgy, we can see those same behavioral models in our own communities that aren't quote unquote mainstream. I have a retreat that I lead called Queer Liberation. Queer liberation is not about love yourself in a world of cisgendered heterosexual people. Queer liberation is love yourself in a world of queer gatekeeping. Love yourself in a world where people say you're not really bisexual because you're in a straight presenting relationship. Love yourself in a world that says you're not really trans because you're not passing. I didn't come out as non-binary or let alone queer until I was 28 years old. I'm turning 32 in a couple months. And part of why I didn't come out was because a member of the community who I looked up to and respected told me, like, men are always trying to take up spaces they don't belong in, you should stop. And I felt so afraid of invading a space that I stopped asking questions, that I stopped trying to explore and understand my own identity. And so many people are being left in the fringes with gatekeeping behaviors that actually reinforce the same paradigms we're trying to break down. So that's what healing is. That's what co-creating a world free of trauma is. Can you stand resolute and true in how you identify yourself and recognize that how you identify yourself when you really know yourself will not at all be impacted by other people's bullshit?
It's so hard because we have to be somewhat healed and have our nervous systems not so stress reactive. And I don't know about you, but sometimes I feel like I'm tired of being the grown up. I'm tired of being the one who has to hold the space. And usually the other person has no idea you're doing that for them and that you're being compassionate. And in fact, they might even walk on your head further because they think you're weak. It's a really hard thing to do, what you're saying.
Can I share a story that
Sure.
actually is relevant to this? So
Yeah.
I was at a wedding of a dear friend from college down at my old campus, St. Mary's College of Southern Maryland, small school. And during the reception, because I've always been like this outward, bubbly social butterfly, one of the bridesmaids who was also a dear friend came up to me and they're like, J Mark, can you please help get people excited and dancing? We're just out there and it's really uncomfortable and awkward, can get people excited. And I was like, sure. I already gave like a speech, even though I wasn't part of any either the bridal or groom party, but I was like, sure, yeah, I was just gonna lay low key, but if this is what you need, I'll do it. So I asked the DJ for a mic and I started getting people hyped up. And this person came up to me and they're like, what are you doing? They're like, stop doing that. And I was like, no, they asked me to do this. And it was like, well, they made the wrong decision. They shouldn't have done that. And I was like, hey, like, I can tell you're active. Do you want to talk about it? Like, no, I don't want to talk to you. And then I got mad. I get being reactive. I can be overstimulating to people. I'm literally married to an autistic person. I know I'm a lot, but you completely shut down my humanity in that moment. And so I did a turn around the dance floor. And then I found another friend of mine who's also a person of color, which is relevant because the person who told me to stop was a white man. And I was like, hey, I am not okay. I'm going to go scream, but could I like vent to you? And so they let me vent a little bit. And they're like, I'll go talk to him because it's weird that he did that. And I was like, okay. And so she went and talked to him. And then I'm sitting at a table talking to some other folks. And he came up to me. First off, I'm in the middle of a conversation. He came up to me to apologize, didn't pull me away, just immediately jumped in, which in my brain clocked as like, oh, someone called you out and you felt bad, but this isn't a real apology. Started with, hey, I'm sorry I said all that. I didn't know that they asked you to do that. I immediately cut him off. I said, no, you don't get to say that to me. He's like, no, but I didn't know, but I told you that they asked me to do that. I told you that they asked me to do this thing. You don't get to come up to me and give this half apology saying you didn't know when that was what I communicated. I understand being overstimulated. I understand that I'm a lot and I get that. But you did not get to talk to me like that and then shut off any opportunity for further communication. You do not get to communicate with me in that way. Once again, I get if that was a lot. I get it was overstimulating. I'm really mad at you right now. And I'm sorry if my energy is a lot right now being really mad at you. But you don't get to do that to me. And you don't get to talk to me like that. That is not okay. And he apologized. And I was like, do you want a hug? Do you want to hug it out? That's totally fine with me. We hugged it out. And then, I
So
went home.
even though you were still so angry and not ready for the apology, you were okay with a hug.
Yeah, because I know it can be very vulnerable having someone call you out on your shit.
Yeah.
But you know what? I went home, deleted him off Facebook. I was like, hey, we had that moment, but if I can't trust that you are emotionally regulated enough to communicate, hey, this is overstimulating for me. Can you please stop? Because the thing, if he was just like, can you please stop? It would have been one thing. It was the added insult and the added shutdown. That was when I got mad. So, like, when I think about being the bigger person, I think people often mistake being the bigger person as never having this kind of like fury in you. It's not that. You can have both. I was angry and I saw him as a human being. I said what I needed to for myself and I allowed him the space to express anything he needed to express. And I deleted him off Facebook after. That all can coexist. I think
Right.
that where we get into the thing where people walk all over you, for me, not speaking of you specifically, but for me, that pertains to more of like, are we stepping into the headspace of healing out of people pleasing, as
Right.
opposed to out of a desire to really radically change and help the world? We all have different roles that we play. And, maybe if it was someone else or if they responded differently, I wouldn't have been so like in my warrior energy at that moment. But that was what was necessary. And, it was really important for me to communicate about his behavior, but not about him as a person. And so that's what I did. I addressed the behavior. I was like, you don't get to talk to me like that. You don't get to express. I understand being upset, still like validating his feelings in that moment while still validating my own. But when I was, privately with my friend, when I was a person of color, the first thing I said was, the audacity of this cishet white boy thinking he can come up to me like that. I got all of that petty energy out before that moment because I'm human and because I'm a queer person of color. Like, I had to get all of that out without escalating an issue with a colleague who understands what it's like being a person of color in this world.
Yeah.
But I made sure I specifically was like, I'm not going to dehumanize you. I'm just going to point out these behaviors are not okay. And for me, I think that's where the balance comes. For me, if it was my old version of myself that wasn't on this healing path, I would have clocked him in the face immediately. I would
Wow.
have ruined that wedding. I would have screamed at him and said all the things I said privately to my friend and
Right.
made this beautiful night terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love what you said. Even though you were angry, you were able to hold your humanity and his humanity and talk about the behavior and how unacceptable that behavior is. To me, that's the key. And I've been doing something recently when I'm really angry. I've been asking GPT chat, like, if someone wanted to hold the other person's humanity and my humanity in this situation, give me an example of what that might look like. Like when I'm angry, I can't even think straight. I can't think about doing all of that while I'm dysregulated. And that is so helpful to even just have an example of what that might look like. And then, of course, I digest that and think through it and say my own piece. But I think for a lot of us, we don't even know how to hold humanity and call people out on their behavior simultaneously.
Yeah, and I think a big part of that is so many of us are ruled by our reactivity.
Yeah.
So, the brain doesn't like discomfort. So when you start feeling pain in the body and emotions, when I work with clients, I tell them to feel on their body and they go, I feel angry. I'm like, no, don't give it a name. How does it feel? I feel sad. No, how does it feel? My chest feels tight. There you go. My shoulders are.
Sensations.
Yeah, sensation, sensation, sensation. Anxiety and excitement feel the same way in the body, right? So
Yeah.
It's all the same. And I have an ADHD moment. Where was I going with this? The thing of the matter is that because people are so uncomfortable with their reactivity, the idea that you can be angry and loving at the same time, I'm not talking abusive behavior, because there are abusers who try that language, and I want to honor and acknowledge that. I mean, literally being like, hey, I'm really angry that you did this thing, but I'm not going to dehumanize you because you did this thing. That's what it is. And the only way to get there is to heal. Because until you normalize joy in your body, anger is going to always be there as like this scary monster that you don't quite know how to get away from. My partner, my spouse, and I have gone through an incredible transition throughout the many phases of our relationship. The most recent almost sounds like moving backwards, because it's completely counter to what you hear a lot of therapists say or a lot of people on social media say, where my partner can be upset with me, but I can also be upset with them. And I think people need to go through this phase anyway. It's like if someone says they're upset with you need to hold space that they're upset with you. And that is important. That's an important stepping stone to get to where we are now. But there was a moment where, I was still navigating and trying to come to terms with having ADHD potentially, and was not taking care of myself. And Ezra had asked me to do something, and I completely forgot, dropped the ball, didn't do it. And then I was at this incredible well-being summit at the Omega Institute in New York. And they actually asked me to speak on stage on the last day. And so I called Ezra. I was really excited. I was like, hey, they want me to speak on stage. This is really, really cool. I've always wanted to do something here. And Ezra goes, I'm mad at you. And I was like, what? It's like, you told me you would do this thing and take it off my plate and you didn't do it. And I'm mad at you. And then I was like, okay, I hear you. I'm also mad at you because I just called you about something I'm really excited about. And instead of being excited for me, you're meeting me with this energy. And that was the first time at that point, 8.5 years, that we were able to be completely present with both things simultaneously. And it
Right.
wasn't like, I'm mad, therefore your mad's invalid. It was very like, you're mad, I'm mad too. I can take ownership of what I did. You can take ownership of what you did. But you can't skip steps to get there. But to me, I think that's what it is when you have two people who have done so much work in self-regulation, you can exist in the entire paradox of human existence all at once.
Right. It's
It's
complicated. Yeah.
complicated as hell, but it's so worth it. Even now, when my partner's going through some medical stuff again, when they were chronically ill, it was a complete headspace of self-sacrifice for me. I don't have room at the table. They're constantly in crisis. How I can't manage this crisis. I have to just reject pieces of myself over and over and over again to make sure they're okay. Now it's like, hey, hon, I'm not okay going through all this. This is hard. I need a moment. I need a break. Being able to do that now and seeing that it's actually strengthening our relationship is something I never would have believed 6 years ago.
Yeah, I'm so resonating with all that you're saying. And,
Yeah.
I recently had a really challenging time with a friend, a few weeks of really hard conversations. And this is exactly what we came to. It's like, yeah, we can both be hurt. We can both love each other. We can both need time away. And we're going to talk in the future. It was just like this weird, complex bowl of emotions that were all happening at once, and we could both be okay with that. And even in our longer discussion, when we finally hashed through it, we both said, well, you were able to hold my humanity. And this was not mean-spirited by either one of us. We weren't out to get each other, but it all needed to be said, and it was hurtful.
There's this really great philosophical framework. I don't remember the person's name. I think it starts with an S, but it's called the hedgehog dilemma. And it's the idea that in the cold of winter, hedgehogs want to cuddle close to feel warm. But to do so, they also run the risk of hurting each other with their spikes. And that's what it is to be human, is if you want to get that warmth and that intimacy, you also have to accept the risk of being hurt. But that's the only way to gain intimacy. And it's not because, like, oh, the world is crappy. No matter what you do, you'll be hurt. It's like, no, it's because we're all coming at it with our own perspectives, our own understandings. I'm very fortunate to be married to an unmasking autistic spouse who's like very direct. I never have to question where I stand with them, which is such a
For better
wonderful
or for
relief.
worse.
For better or for worse, I never have to question whether or not they're okay with me. I still do sometimes because it's a great way of revealing my own insecurities. But, like, Yeah, you're gonna be hurt. If you want intimacy, pain is a part of it. But guess what? So is warmth, and so is love and kindness and compassion. And then eventually, you know, the amount of times you hurt each other, the hedgehogs make adjustments. You don't hurt each other as much over time.
So, J. Mark, let's have one final question, which leads into the work that you do and how people could contact you if they wanted to begin the
Sure.
journey with you. For someone struggling right now that's listening to this and saying, everything that J. Mark said is exactly resonating with me, where do you suggest they begin this healing journey towards self-empowerment?
Yeah, so if you have not been to a therapist yet, I always recommend like try doing that first and don't be afraid of treating it like speed dating. I think oftentimes people think they go to a therapist once or twice, it goes badly, therapy is not for them. No, it's just you got to find the person who's the right fit. Treat it like speed dating. That's totally fine. But if you've already gone through the unpacking process, in my experience, anecdotally speaking, therapy has a bit of a plateau period where you've been going for however many years and it's just the same thing over and over again. Then to me, it's like, okay, you're ready for the next step. In which case, it is asking yourself, what does my life look like without being triggered all the time? That's it. And you know, there's a necessary avoidant period where you have to avoid triggers. But to heal, you actually have to confront your triggers. You have to teach your brain to no longer be triggered by that stimuli. And so if that's something that you feel courageously ready to do, I would be honored to serve and support you. I often say, if you really want to do this work in a meaningful way, do my 3-month program first, and then we can talk about ongoing support afterwards. Because my 3-month program is a fully holistic, like the first month is all about the brain, because I'm a big believer in the context of science. So the first month is just like, hey, here's the brain, here's the nervous system, here's how the neural pathways, here's the trauma manifested, all that. The second month is about the body. So how is your body a part of this journey for you? But also, how do you embody these practices to actually make them work? And then the third month is spirit. It's a lot of Buddhism talk, but I'm not trying to convert anybody. It's just the lens through which I contextualize a lot of things. And then afterwards, I have a number of clients that I'm still working with ongoing who've completed that program. But the biggest thing is if you want to start this journey, if you're listening and you're like, I want to do this now, reach out now. Like literally, my contact will be in the description somewhere in the outro, intro. Do it while you have that urge, because our brains are very good at convincing us to not, and very good at finding reasons to not. And those precious moments where you're like, I need to do this now, are moments you have to seize when they come up. Because not to be morbid, but like we all have a finite time here on Earth. And I'm so grateful that I have had the honor and opportunity and pleasure of experiencing at least the last 4 years of my life being so present. And I still have some grief for the previous 28 years, but hopefully I get to live much longer and I get to be one of the few people who can say, like, yeah, I've lived a full life and I was fully present with all of it. And if that's something that you want for yourself, and if you want to be able to hold these relationships without being fearful. And if you want to know yourself too, authenticity is not a platitude. It is an essential human component to thriving, to going beyond the survival state. If you find yourself like, my relationships, like I feel lonely when I'm with them, well, it's likely because you don't know yourself fully. You know something's off and you're masking in some way, or people pleasing or giving up too much of yourself. And once again, social media would be like, these people won't be around you anymore because they don't have any more use out of you. It's like, no, it's because you provided an expectation for the dynamic. And now that you're becoming more yourself, you need new dynamics. And that's okay. It doesn't have to be a blame or shame game, or it doesn't have to be like, oh, these people are monsters. They've been using me my whole life. It could just be like, oh, I've been giving up too much of myself and I deserve relationships where I no longer do that. So yeah, you can reach out. I'd be honored to support you. I do an intake call with everyone, and I've said no more than I've said yes. I don't want that to scare you, but it's because A, is my neurodivergent queer self a good fit for you? And B, are you ready for the work? And it's not easy work. I could make my offering cheap and digestible and very good for capitalistic consumers, but I don't show up like that because I know that when you really do the work, it is a commitment and it is difficult, but it's so worth it at the other end.
Yeah. Well, I feel like we've had a wonderful conversation, and I'm so grateful for how you are showing up authentically. I think it's such a role model for anyone watching on YouTube or listening to this conversation. And it's rare. Even people who believe they're being authentic, oftentimes we're fooling ourselves, but I can feel it. I can feel it. And that might be one of the gifts of if you do have neurodivergent tendencies. I think one of the beautiful things about that is you can't help but show up as yourself.
Very true. Yes.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. It's been lovely to spend this time with you.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. It's been such an honor, and you're so wonderful.
I want to thank J. Mark Axentoe for being with us today. And we didn't get a chance while they were still on the video here with me, but I'm going to show you their website, www.jemarcaxinto.com. And J. Mark has that exact handle on all the social medias of Instagram and Facebook and everything else. And I feel like I have, this sounds kind of strange, but I feel like I've fallen in love with this human in the last hour, not in a romantic way. Clearly, I have a partner and J. Mark has a partner, and we're not talking about romance, but from a perspective of deep human connection and understanding. My heart feels so open right now, and I feel seen and heard and understood. And I feel like I have met someone that I hope also feels seen and heard and understood by both me and hopefully all of you as the listeners. It's just so rare in these times to be able to be so present together and to share the complexities of relationship. While we call people out and at the same time hold their humanity and maybe even give a hug. Like, I just feel like this whole last 2 months, that's what my life has been about, is speaking my truth, setting the boundaries, telling people how their actions and behaviors are impacting me. And at the same time saying, I love you and I hope we can still continue a relationship because there's something here for us. I know we're both good people who want connection. And there's no reason our disagreements need to interfere with that, but we do have to get some clarity together and we do need to speak our truth. And let's try to do that. So this interview is just so affirming and I hope you enjoyed it. And I hope that you'll find J. Mark online, social media, but also their website, and maybe even try this 3 month course on their website because I think it would be a great place to start as you take back your power, radical authenticity through healing your trauma. Okay, everybody, have a great day, and I look forward to seeing you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Yoga Therapy Hour podcast. After several years of beta testing, we are finally ready to build a community around a mobile app. The Optimal State app on Android Store and in the iPhone Store. On this app, we're going to start hosting classes, regular meditation circles, and really start to build a community of yoga teachers, yoga therapists, Ayurvedic practitioners, and healthcare practitioners that want to come together on a regular basis and have a community that is empathetic and compassionate and kind and full of goodness that wants to grow spiritually together. So come on over to the app. You can download it now, try it for a month for free, and we'll be having regular community online offerings through the app, and we would love to see you over there. All right, we'll see you soon. A special thank you to our team here at Optimal State. We are truly a global family. George Mantuan, one of our executive producers. Adam Satchel, senior media producer and sound engineer from the Philippines. Krishna Panchal, a producer from Canada. Modupe Abdullahi, who does the show notes and is an editor for us from Nigeria. And Peter Morley, who wrote and produced the music for this show, who lives in Australia. Find more about Peter's work at www.zenmusic.biz. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.